Matthew, this is, we just had to give a few organizational instructions here because our viewers can now, they have a choice. They can either view and listen to us in English, the original version, or they can hear a synchronized, a German synchronized version. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me back on. And it's a pleasure to go over some very big and meaty ideas for you and your audience once more.
Yeah, we can't wait to hear this. It looks like very, very hot topics that you're going to be talking about.
Well, I'll try to make them as interesting as possible. And indeed, these are multiply connected ideas. I am very happy that we have some live translations, and so I will do my best to speak slowly for sympathy with the translator as I possibly can, though I apologize immediately to the translator because I sometimes do move faster than my mouth should permit. So I do apologize if that happens.
You're doing pretty well right now.
Okay, good. So let me just begin with a little bit of a screen share. I took the liberty to make a little bit of a PowerPoint featuring some of the ideas I outlined in a recent article that I was asked to speak about today, entitled Hyperinflation, Fascism, and War, How the New World Order Could Be Averted Once More. Mm-hmm. It does touch upon some of the themes that I raised, if anybody has watched the last presentation I gave for your committee about 6 weeks ago, though it does differ. One thing that I think most people have come to realize now is that there's more to this than simply the fraudulent science behind a pandemic. There has been an idea that was circulated, I think, January of 2020 originally from the World Economic Forum itself around the idea of a great reset. So I want to give a little bit of meat onto the bones of that. Mm-hmm. Klaus Schwab himself had said in his own words that the world must act jointly and swiftly to revamp all aspects of our society and economies from cultural to social contracts and working conditions. Every country from the United States to China must participate, and every industry from oil and gas to tech must be transformed. In short, we need a great reset of capitalism. So this is something which is a creepy idea, but it's something which has been permeating many of the circles around the World Economic Forum, the Davos crowd, is that the current crisis isn't really a crisis so much of it being an opportunity to fast track the shutting down, the reset and creation of a new system, which is not just economic. And it's not just about coronavirus, but it blends in. Every aspect of human society, cultural, as he says, education, political, strategic, and even the COP26 summit that's coming up in the UK, overseen by World Economic Forum trustee Mark Carney, makes it very well known that it's not really just about the climate crisis, but rather the climate crisis as well as COVID-19, which together are being merged into one strange problem that we're all supposed to be afraid of and modify our behavior globally around. I'm going to just get at what is underlying this. Because this didn't just crop up yesterday. It didn't crop up in June 2020. In fact, even going back to September and August of 2019, you had people like the former head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, who said that we are on the verge of a financial Armageddon. This is before coronavirus. Even before that, you had the head of BlackRock, Vice Chair Philip Hildebrand of BlackRock, which manages trillions of dollars of U.S. asset purchasing right now, who said that we need a global financial regime change. Again, August 2019 at the Jackson Hole Central Bankers Conference. So again, did this begin at that date in August 2019? No, it didn't. But there's been something that COVID was created and sprung onto the world as a cover to manage something that was going to happen anyway, even without COVID. Now, COVID did accelerate the rates of collapse, the breakdown of supply chains, yes, but it did not. Anybody who says that it caused it would be a fool or a liar.
Matthew,
one of the things,
Matthew, can I quickly interrupt? Because there's one question I've been meaning to ask for a long time. When you showed us the picture of Klaus Schwab, what is it with this guy? I mean, what kind of suit is he wearing? What is the medallion or whatever it is that he's wearing? Does he think he's Darth Vader or something?
I don't know. He's really playing into this evil, you know, genius thing from from Austin Powers. I don't know. It's a bit of a joke.
That's okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought maybe you knew what this is about, but maybe he's just.
Unfortunately, I don't know what's going through his sick mind. No. If I find out, I'll let you know.
Okay.
But no, so getting back on track, the systemic breakdown was something which was well underway already a decade ago. This is a 12-year-old overview of the rate of growth of the derivatives cancer. Essentially, back in the 1980s, early 80s, one would have gone to jail for the types of gambling on junk bonds, which has become common practice in the modern day banking system. Deutsche Bank is highly infested with this. Mm-hmm. This is a breakdown of the big American too big to fail banks, with JP Morgan being the most infested with over $80 trillion of derivatives. But overall, this is about $708 trillion, which is essentially unpayable debts of a variety of sorts that have been securitized, that have been insured, that have been gambled upon. On spot markets, on long-term futures markets, commodities markets. And at this point, when this graph was put together, this already was about 20 times more or 10 times more than the world GDP, which was about $80 trillion. Since 2008, 2009, the derivatives have only skyrocketed. There's been more loopholes created in things like Dodd-Frank's, and it's very difficult for even professional economists to calculate how many there are in the system because they are so nefarious, opaque, and difficult to even measure. But all that to say, these are largely based upon a bubble which has at its foundations unpayable forms of debts in still subprime housing, corporate debt, other forms of junk bonds, even national debts of various sorts that won't be paid. And when the defaults start, you will have a deleveraging like we've never seen before. On top of that, we have the additional problem of COVID having created $24 trillion of additional global debts, $8 trillion in the United States alone. Supply chains, as I've mentioned, have begun to break down, and consumer price inflation indexes have also increased by about 4% just in the last year alone. And we're just on the tip of something. Deutsche Bank chief economist David Fuchs-Landau recently said that we're on the verge of a chain reaction financial crisis. His solution is idiotic because he just thinks we should increase interest rates like we did in the early 80s. The idiocy of this is that in the 80s, that really just destroyed whatever little small and medium enterprises existed. I can go through that a little bit. I've got four slides in the present age, and then we're going to jump back into the contents of my article, and which also takes a part of a book that I'm about to publish. It's volume two of my Clash of the Two Americas, which people can get off of the CanadianPatriot.org or RisingTideFoundation.net websites to get the fuller story. But all that to say, the sort of thing that we need to look at underlying behind the derivatives is the breakdown of the real economy. And so something happened around the time of the early 70s, a shift occurred. This is a 1947 to 2009 trend breakdown of manufacturing with the increase of what's called the FIRE economy as per a percentage of GDP overall. That's finance, insurance, and real estate versus the productive sector of manufacturing. And so going back to really just 1971, we have still 22% of the overall GDP being manufacturing. And the FIRE economy is still relatively small in proportion. Today, that has bubbled to be double the manufacturing financial services. Another way of looking at the same sort of thing is this other graph, which showcases the collapse of industry and agriculture over the same period, with the increase of services, the services economy, which really began springing up, you know, going back to just 1970, still, you had about 30% of the distribution of the labor force working in manufacturing, added to agro-industrial, that was over 40%, and services since 1970, 68, has just taken over the majority of the economy. And this was a period where we became a services consumer economy. The idea was in the early 70s that the dollar would be floated from the fixed exchange rate system, which would had formerly dominated the post-World War II years. And that's when you had the biggest rates of technological growth, buying power, living standards was the 25, 30 year periods after World War II, when big economic projects were being built in North America and in Europe. After that, the decision was made, which I'll go into, on the part of certain forces that took over control of the US presidency under George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, people like Zbigniew Brzezinski later with the Trilateral Commission, and David Rockefeller, who was the founder of the Trilateral Commission. They initiated this sleight of hand, which said, no, we used to be an industrial economy. Now that's over. We're going into the post-industrial model. We will now begin floating the dollar, which will now be valued on the markets. The markets will determine the price of dollar as well as oil, which will be integrated. That was called the petrodollar, created by Kissinger in 73. And increasingly, that would be accompanied by mass deregulation and a focus on myopic making money now. No big projects, no long-term intentions to build things for the future like we used to do. That was the old wisdom. So the consequence of this wasn't just the breakdown, the atrophy of our infrastructure. We had also the collapse of agricultural output began to melt down. The U.S. machine tool sector collapsed by 45% in the 1980s alone. Automobile production collapsed 44%, steel production 49%. Bankruptcies by 1980-82 skyrocketed because with the massive interest rates of the 70s, Volcker, the federal chairman and Trilateral Commission member, called for a controlled disintegration, which is a strange choice of words, I must say, which involved increasing interest rates for 2 years to 20%, which again, the only people who could survive those were big behemoths like Walmarts. Everybody who was the backbone of the economy, much of the American Mittelstand, was wiped out during this process. So additionally, infrastructure-wise, we just had an atrophy where we began to create not just speculation onto fictitious capital like junk bonds, which became normalized by 1987 under Greenspan when the economy was about to collapse during Black Tuesday, which was a period which people were afraid was going to be like a new Great Depression. Greenspan's solution with the collapse of the Dow Jones by 25% was to say, no, let's just increase junk bonds and speculation on derivatives. That's what created the current crisis. And meanwhile, the physical economy was permitted to continue to atrophy. Infrastructure today, the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that about $4 trillion is needed for infrastructure just to bring it to maintenance to safety levels, let alone improvement. So we lost something in terms of a wisdom of thinking about the future at the time that people like Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated and his brother earlier, John F. Kennedy. Another way of looking at this is the collapse of R&D, which went down from 2.5% overall research and development by government spending in 1971 to 0.4% today. The thing that drove much of the U.S. economy, which was the space program, really peaked at a 4.5% spending in 1965, before the moon landing. After that, it began to be severed, cut down year to year, to the point that as soon as somebody played golf on the moon in 1973, the whole Apollo space mission was shut down and funding was never brought back up above 1% of GDP. Today, it's far lower. The space program, people have to understand, drove the entire economy. Microwave technology, GPS, internet, medical breakthroughs, everything. There's hardly a thing in our system today which has not been radically revolutionized by the space program of the 60s. So that was shut down. The capacities we had to change the nature of the system we live in by scientific and technological progress was taken down so that we remained within a fixed system, reliant upon diminishing rates of oil, of coal, of things that were being monopolized by certain figures. that you would find, I think, today very active around the World Economic Forum, which was then still just coming into being in 1971, 72. Henry Kissinger, by the way, being somebody who Klaus Schwab said is one of his key mentors and one of the minds behind the World Economic Forum originally in 71, as were people like Alexander King and Aurelio Peccei, who headed the Club of Rome that presented in many of the conferences in Davos in 72, 73, that were trying to get across that humanity had to recognize its limits to growth. The last slide I have for our modern age is the breakdown of investments into fusion power, which back in the 60s, 70s, people believed was the next thing to replace fossil fuels and limited resources, was the breakthrough into the atom. The sad fact was that the investment levels were cut down so that the scientists would be demoralized. They would not have the financial resources to build prototypes, to test their ideas, and they were let to grow old and die away so that the new breed of people who are working on fusion science are trained not by reality or having done experiments, but increasingly on computer models that don't have necessarily a bearing on how physical reality works. This is also a crisis we have in engineering, where many of the engineers who built the big projects and have the living experience are in their 80s, 90s, or older, or dead, leaving newer generations who are being trained off of computer model thinking without an ability to really think through what is it like to really build a society. This is a huge cultural crisis we have to think about. I have three quotes here that I just think punctuate the idea very well of what was going on, what was the intention of the idea. And I accept being labeled a conspiracy theorist. I wear it as a badge of honor. When you read some of these books written by those who made policy back then, one couldn't really avoid it. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who became a leading controller of President Carter and even Ford, was a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, which really took control in the 1970s, as I mentioned. He wrote a book which can, in many ways, be seen as the manifesto of the Trilateral Commission, called Between Two Ages, America and the Technotronic Era, wherein he wrote in 1970, the technotronic era, as he calls it, involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled society. Such a society would be dominated by an elite, unrestrained by traditional values. Soon, it will be possible to assert almost continuous surveillance over every citizen and maintain up-to-date complete files containing even the most personal information about the citizen. These files will be subject to instantaneous retrieval by the authorities. Now, I mean, just looking at how some of these creepy figures pushing vaccine passports and different forms of social credit fiascos, just think about how they're thinking and think about what people like Zbigniew is saying here early on. This is right before the US dollar was floated onto the floating exchange rates and detached from the gold reserve system. One of Huntington's projects was the creation of a trilateral commission book called Crisis in Democracy, co-written by one of his associates named Samuel P. Huntington, who has been a frequent participant at the Davos summit. He's actually the one who coined the term the Davos man, the gold collar generation, as he calls it, in 2004. Samuel P. Huntington wrote in this book, 1975, we have come to recognize that there are potential desirable limits to economic growth. There are also potentially desirable limits to the indefinite extension of democracy. A government which lacks authority will have little ability to impose on its people the sacrifices that will be necessary. So in his mind, what is a government for? Is it for the defense of the general welfare of the people or the defense of the common good? No, it's to impose sacrifices onto people. That's the point of governments. There's no other purpose but that. And certainly when you look at people like Mark Carney and other devotees of the World Economic Forum, that is the only view that they see of as a purpose for governments, is to be an extension of those who wish to have a stakeholder capitalism or a fourth industrial revolution, to impose austerity, draconian cuts in living standards onto people, but not to protect people from them, which was the whole point of why sovereign governments, this is my words now, but the whole reason why sovereign governments were created to begin with was to organize by the people to protect ourselves from those types of sociopathic forces wishing to hurt people and destroy their freedoms. That's what the American Revolution was about, which people who claim themselves to be American despise so much. A Canadian who spent much of his time doing a lot of destruction to both Canada and the United States was also referred to by Klaus Schwab as his mentor, was a co-founder of and former chairman of the World Economic Forum, Maurice Strong. Maurice Strong did many things in his life, none of which being very good. But one of the things he did that was very, I think, insightful was he said in, he gave an interview called The Wizard of Baca Grande, which is an estate that runs, controls much of the water aquifers in the United States that he happens to own. And this person who's in many ways the grandfather of the modern environmentalist movement, he was the co-founder also of the Club of Rome of Canada, said that he was musing about a book he would like to write, he says, in hindsight. But he said, what if a small group of world leaders were to conclude that the principal risk of the to the earth comes from the actions of the rich countries? And if the world is to survive, those rich countries would have to sign an agreement reducing their impact on the environment. 1991, he's saying this. Will they do it? The group's conclusion is no. The rich countries won't do it. They won't change. So in order to save the planet, the group decides, isn't the only hope for the planet that the industrialized civilizations collapse? Isn't it our responsibility to bring that about? Just let that sit there for some people who might be a little horrified or shocked that he just said it. So you got to keep in mind that the there's a certain ethical charge, almost religious in its hate for human beings and what human beings do. Because when human beings have freedom, when we have access to basic qualities of our creative reason, our full faculties are given to us because we've had a good education, we've had a good culture, we're part of a society which is going somewhere, which has a future. We have security in that sense for the future. What we do tend to do is we want to make things better when we problem solve. The manifestation, the way that expresses itself is through overcoming limits to growth. We're not satisfied with just saying like 100 years ago, you know, standard of life expectancy in Montreal was maybe 45 years of age on average, high infant mortality. We didn't have access to many of the resources that we have today. Supercomputers, things like that were an imaginary thing. So we encouraged a culture of creative discovery that then allowed us to leap over the limits to growth by discovering new laws of the universe and applying them to benefit humankind. Discovering that new things on the periodic table, which we did not think had value, like thorium was an element that we used to not do very much with until the advent of nuclear technology, which allowed us to then tap into the energy of thorium for reactors that could power life for human beings. So we change our relationship to the periodic table, which no other animal does. People like Maurice Strong, like Alexander King, Klaus Schwab, Kissinger, all of these creepy figures despise that characteristic because they're control freaks. Whenever we do that, we become very difficult to control. The things that they monopolized no longer have the value in controlling the system. So you break the rules of the game, and the great game must never have its rules broken. First rule of the great game, don't break the rules of the great game or else assassinate the leader who tries. So that for some words of opening, I think the other second half of my presentation, I'll try to move faster through some history and wrap this up within an hour. It's total.
I find it incredible that we're obviously dealing in a number of, actually a whole procession of psychiatrists, professors of psychiatry and psychology have confirmed this to us. Isn't it incredible that we're dealing obviously with psychopaths?
We are. It's difficult for a lot of people to see it because they're masquerading under a veneer of morality and empathy, right? But it's really that. And it shows you as well, too, that morality has more than just emotion to it. You could be a very emotional person who feels very strongly about things, but it doesn't mean that you're not going to do evil. There's something more to it that, you know, the emotions have to be matured along with the mind, with reason. And together they have to harmonize for us to really be sure that we are not other directed. To be sovereign as a sovereign society means every individual has to be able to internally generate the decisions within themselves about what is their nation, what is the future, what is the past, how do they fit themselves as an identity within a process that's bigger than themselves. And see, the thing about a consumer society that was created in the early 70s is it detaches everybody from the continuity of the whole that they are parts of, right? We're all mortal, we're gonna die, but we can all freely choose to organize our identities around something bigger. And this is why the oligarchy has put so much effort into cutting us off of certain things like the family unit, religion, national sentiments. These have all been targeted for cutting off so that we would all just float around like myopic little particles within a stochastic machine that could be then thus easily controlled like a herd in some predetermined direction. Mm. That's not human nature. That's more like what you could get animals to maybe do in a herd. But even then, animals wouldn't willfully destroy their own children. So anyway, back into a little bit of historical precedent, because even this, what we're seeing right now, this dynamic from 1968-70 onward is not without precedence. And we have elements that are akin to hyperinflation because we have been printing money with no foundation to it. But it's also akin to, and that's sort of what we've seen in 1923 Weimar, which I'll go through. Mm-hmm. But it also has elements of the 1929 meltdown of the Great Depression, which wasn't really hyperinflation. If anything, that was deflationary. That was a speculative bubble system of the 1920s that was created under deregulation from 1923 onward, and junk bonds, effectively bad debts, which I'll go through, were created that ultimately deleveraged under defaults. So we have a bit of a combination of both. But even though this is somewhat new today in our world, the solutions are relatively the same in principle. And I'm going to look at what were some of the solutions that could have been done in 1923 that certain brave people attempted. How was that subverted? And again, we'll look at the case study of 1929 to 33. So the League of Nations in the wake of World War I, which is a war that should never have happened. There's no reason why World War I happened to this very day. And I challenge people to find a history professor that will give them a satisfying reason why World War I happened. The only people who have a satisfying answer are people who have looked at the British intelligence running the show, who under people like King Edward VII had managed to create a triple entente specifically to destroy the potential alliance of Russia, Germany, and even the United States in the 19th century, which was being organized by people like Otto von Bismarck, Count Sergei Witte, the Prime Minister of Russia, Gabriel Hanotaux, the Foreign Minister of France, as well as Sadi Carnot, the assassinated President of France in 1895. So there was the need to destroy something in the mind of British imperialists that was organizing itself around protectionism, around large-scale rail projects, development of long-term credit, using the Abraham Lincoln economic paradigm. At the time in Germany, it took the form of Frederick List and the Frederick List movement of industrialization, getting rid of British free trade by going for protectionism and working together bilaterally and trilaterally with other countries for win-win cooperation. The Berlin to Baghdad railway that Bismarck had put into motion was a part of this to modernize the Ottoman Empire. All that to say, it's only by looking at the conspiracy to destroy that dynamic by the part of the British Empire that needed to keep the world under maritime control of sea lanes, which is what the British had used to maintain its world empire. You without that, you couldn't understand why World War I happened. All that to say, World War I did happen. Unfortunately, idiots went along with a self-destructive policy and it turned into a four-year meat grinder. The outcome was the creation of the League of Nations. The 1918 armistice was effectively a total looting of Germany. The dismantling of the Navy, the imposition of $132 billion gold marks of debts that were, everyone knew was unpayable. That was not a secret. The giving up of territories, Alsace, Lorraine, Ruhr, North Silesia, Germany lost 15% of their arable land, 75% of their iron ore production, 26% of coal production, 8,000 locomotives and 225,000 rail cars were all confiscated by the victor nations. As so the means of producing wealth, real wealth, was destroyed, was taken away from Germany. And they were just told to pay these debts that you, how are you going to pay that? And so on the one hand, they were told, much like today's IMF and World Bank economists telling poor indebted countries that were only indebted because they took on conditionality-laced loans, they were told, well, stop your imports, increase exports. So Germany did that, and both collapsed within the year by 60%, imports and exports alike. There was nothing left except turn on the printing press. And so we know the horror story, where $1 would $1 would be purchased for one Reichsmark in 1913. By the time that hyperinflation really began to strike, that amounted in, by October 1923, there was 496 quintillion gold marks in circulation. It was just being printed and printed with, and value was completely destroyed. It took something like, 428 billion Reichsmarks to buy one loaf of bread. It was devastating. And so people, as you can see in this image, were playing with bricks of money, little kids, people were carrying wheelbarrows. They were, and within the course of a day, the value would plummet, but it would lose double its value easily. So people had to spend their money as soon as they got it. But it was devastating. Industry now collapsed 50%. Physical industry collapsed 50%. Unemployment rose to 30%. And for those who had some money to spare, many of the Germans went a little bit crazy and were even short selling against their own mark to try to make money. Kind of like what's happening today, where people are short selling against the value of the US dollar, which is only itself increasing the likelihood or speed at which that dollar will collapse even further. So it was bad. People were burning this stuff to stay warm. Now, I alluded to this in my last presentation. I do want to say a little bit more about this. The resistance involved people. There was resistance. It didn't have to go this way. What we have here are Warren Harding, the new American president between 1920 and 1923. We have to the right of him, Georgi Chechenin, the Russian foreign minister. To the bottom left, we have Kurt von Schleicher, who was the assistant at the time to Walter Rathenau, the foreign minister of Germany. Together, the Rathenau and Chechenin and also Schleicher organized what was called in secret the Rapallo, a treaty in Italy, where the Germans and the Russians together basically had a treaty of goodwill to say we will forgive each other's any debts we owe each other. We will forgive. We will have a new military cooperation, but also we will have investments into each other's infrastructure. Germany had a lot of specialists, a lot of people who needed work. Russia wanted to build infrastructure and electrification. And they had a program to begin to heal each other's devastated economies after World War II that way outside of the League of Nations. The League of Nations was created as a kind of like a Great Reset agenda today. It was a proposition by the British delegation mostly. People like Lloyd George, the Roundtable Movement, Alfred Milner, who headed the Versailles Treaty, they created the League of Nations at the same time to basically say we don't need nation states anymore. We need to create a world government where nations don't control their economy, they don't control their military. That's where Article 10 of the League of Nations was set up as a collective security pact. That became the model later on for the creation of NATO. That's what Article 5 is based on, is the League of Nations. And sovereignty will be made obsolete so that we don't have wars anymore, was the argument. Because obviously nation states cause wars. That's the only thing nation states are good for, is causing wars. So if you want to get rid of wars, get rid of nation states. That's the formula. That's not new. So these guys basically went outside of that and they created something that would have involved no hyperinflation in Germany, because it would have helped Germany rebuild its physical economy and infuse real value back into the dollar while also forgiving massive amounts of these war reparations. Warren Harding was the president that many people are not aware of, who was a very great man, greater than people realize, and who tried to bring back many of Abraham Lincoln's measures in many ways. Unfortunately, and he even had a program to recognize Russia after World War I. He had a program to have the world's biggest trade agreement, $3 billion a trade agreement with Russia was being finalized by Warren Harding. That was all part of this trilateral program of cooperation and development. Unfortunately, so the story, as history unfolded, this fell apart, unfortunately, when Rathenau was killed by the organization Consul, which later on became broken up when it was illegalized. This organization, it was a terrorist group that had killed over 300 German politicians in only 4 years. That's a huge number. Rathenau, once he was killed, it was illegalized officially. It took them a long time to illegalize it, but they did. And it became a number of smaller paramilitary groups, the biggest one being the Freikorps, which was the military arm of the National Socialist Party of Germany. So they continued in a new form under new protection. You had Warren Harding, unfortunately, also not live out his presidency. He died in 1923 of poisoning, of oyster poisoning. No autopsy was ever conducted on the body, but we do know that the effect of Warren Harding's death was the takeover of the U.S. economy by J.P. Morgan, Andrew Mellon, who was the Treasury Secretary, and people like Coolidge simply did what we did in more recent years. They liberalized the economy, deregulated it, allowed for people, speculators, to access people's savings, to gamble. And the outcome of that was the creation of a new bubble. And the Roaring Twenties are called that because it was like a party, easy money, easy alcohol as well. It was prohibition, but didn't stop people. And that's the reason why prohibition was created. There's a whole book that's been written on this called Dope Inc., was to create organized crime syndicates that would then be useful in the post-prohibition age. But all that to say, the Roaring Twenties involved the creation of what are called broker call loans. Brokers, stockbrokers, could borrow more money than they had for speculative purposes, which began at $1.5 billion. It skyrocketed by night to 1927 to $5.7 billion, and it continued to skyrocket to become overvalued by fourfold of the whole economy. And on a specific day in 1929, everybody on JP Morgan's preferred clients list called in their broker call loans at the same time on the minute, where everybody, all of these brokers, then all of a sudden had to pay the debts that they owed, but they didn't have real money. And so what happened was a run on the banks, defaults and a run on the banks. The only people who didn't suffer were people who were on JP Morgan's preferred clients list that had insider trading information and were able to sell their stocks before the financial blowout happened and then purchase their things for pennies on the dollar. This list became public during the Pecora hearings in 1933-34 under Ferdinand Pecora. This was well known at the time. Cartoons like this brilliant cartoon were circulated in magazines across the United States, featuring an image of J.P. Morgan. His son, John Pierpont, was the controller of those days of the U.S. economy. And the blowout involved a four-year shock therapy. It was really a psychological trauma on the American and also Canadian and European population of unemployment, which skyrocketed to 25%. You had industrial capacity collapsing by 70%. The means of production, the means of sustaining life, was shut down. Agricultural prices fell far below the ability for farmers to pay for the cost of overhead, you know, employees, materials, seeds, tractors, all of these things they couldn't afford to maintain. So farms were shutting down. Suicides had skyrocketed. People were starving in America. Life savings were lost as 4,000 banks failed. And again, the speculators who created the crisis were speculating on savings because there was no split between commercial and investment banks at the time in the Great Depression. So the solution that was being sold, oh, this is a picture of Senator George Norris, who worked very closely with Franklin Roosevelt, who in the 1920s had a committee hearing where he was basically just showcasing this image of Wall Street's control over private public sector foundations. Rockefeller Foundation is on there. So this is, again, it's not a new thing. This was in the Senate of the United States being demonstrated by people who were in the know of what was really controlling their collapse into a depression. And what was the solution being offered by the part of those who created the depression was fascism. So in the United States, the fascist parties were being celebrated by Time magazine. Henry Luce, who ran Time and Fortune, were big fascists who had Mussolini on Time magazine's covers 8 times, even after World War II began. Hitler, man of the year. And this was being, again, sold that you can put bread on your tables if you just accept this new great innovative economic system called fascism, corporate fascism. It had different variants to it, but that was something that we had seen now with the rise of Hitler as a solution as well to the economic woes of Germany. Kurt von Schleicher pushed back against this, the assistant to Rathenau, but as I mentioned in my last presentation, he was ousted in a bit of a soft coup in 33 in January when Hitler was installed. And by a couple of months later, the Reichstag was burnt down in an inside job, blamed on a bunch of anarchist communists and justified a new dictatorship. Meanwhile, Schleicher and hundreds of Hitler's enemies were all killed during the Night of the Long Knives. So this was being pushed in the United States as well. The fortunate thing was that you had a large fight. There's a documentary called 1932, Speak Not of Parties, but of Universal Principles, produced by LPAC, which people can Google and watch. It's a very good documentary going through the fight leading up to Franklin Roosevelt's success in 1932. In his inaugural speech, he made the point that the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit. What you have on the left-hand side is an image from the London conference. It was a central banker's Great Reset type conference in 1933 that not many people know about, which was brought together by the League of Nations, the Bank of England, and the Bank of International Settlements, the latter being the central bank of central banks created in 1930 specifically to facilitate debt repayments by Germany to the West. Now, this bank also became Hitler's bank, which facilitated the takeover of Czech gold to the Nazi coffers. It continued to be a tool used to drive the Nazi machine throughout World War II. But anyhow, this conference was a 6-month conference bringing together 65 countries around solving the world economic depression by creating new powers to central banks and stabilizing currencies under mathematical equilibrium. So the idea was to impose new rules onto nation states, saying that no nation could get out of balance with their debts and what they could produce for other countries. So this required the US to cooperate. Fortunately, Franklin Roosevelt pulled the United States out of all cooperation with this conference and said, basically, he called it the mathematical fetishes of international bankers are trying to take precedence over sovereign nation states. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he said in a speech. And he basically said, we're not going to participate. We need to first do a real national economic recovery. It doesn't mean that he didn't believe we needed a new economic system. He did believe that, but he believed that nation states needed to heal so that sovereign nation states could be the force driving that recovery and not private central bankers. That's a very important difference. And the recovery process, the healing of the sick tissue was the key. How did he heal the sick tissue? Well, first, he didn't just destroy this Great Reset conference in London. He also declared war on the Wall Street power structures that were funding fascism by doing several things at the same time inside of the United States. On the one hand, he forced through Glass-Steagall bank separation, breaking up the banks, saying you couldn't no longer be a bank that did speculation as well as commercial banking that lent to the real economy. You had to pick one or the other. If you were a normal useful bank, you would receive government insurance called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So if something went wrong, we would protect you as the government. But if you were a speculator, there'd be no too big to fails. We would not bail you out. You take your loss and you collapse if you're bankrupt. That's the way it should always be. Now, this was made possible because of the fight by Ferdinand Pecora, who was given powers to go into JP Morgan's banks with subpoena powers and audit their books, which he did with teams of auditors, forcing the revelation of the preferred clients lists, which had Andrew Mellon on it, as well as Coolidge, the former president. But it also just showcased for the American public what were the abuses of these bankers that such that they created the bubbles that were induced to pop. And that gave Roosevelt the type of support he needed. Because keep in mind, a lot of these people, these same bankers and financiers who were fascists, like the Hearst Foundation, you know, William Randolph Hearst, Henry Luce, they ran much of the media as well. So how was, it was a big fight over the, who would control the education of the people. So these things were very necessary to put into the spotlight. Overall, a bankruptcy reorganization, there was a bank holiday. And for the banks that were solvent, which were 75%, they were reopened, put back in business. Confidence began to be restored. For those that were insolvent, they were put out of business. The SEC, the Security Exchange Commission, to oversee Wall Street's abuses was created. FDR even put the Federal Reserve for the first time under federal mandate by installing his own ally, Mariner Eccles, as Fed chair, who forced it in a limited way for the first time to behave like an instrument sometimes of the government, not always, because it was still run by a lot of international financiers who didn't care about nation states. And to get around the Federal Reserve, which is a private central bank, this is not actually federal, he amplified the power of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which by 1942 was lending over 50% to the real economy. 50% of the lending that was happening was through not any banks. It certainly was not the Wall Street banks. They were constricting, private banks were constricting lending to the real economy. It was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which acted like a national bank. And things like the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau after World War II was modeled to reconstruct Germany on the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. That's an important lesson for people to keep that in mind. Protectionism, the stopping of dumping of cheap goods that would destroy the physical economy, that had been a technique by the British Empire for hundreds of years. Protectionism, protective tariffs are the only way to stop that from happening. That's also what FDR did massively. On a positive note, these were all sort of negative measures to stop the evil, but to do good. Was a different matter or similar, but it was made possible by this. You had 45,000 infrastructure projects, small and large, built in only 6 years after 1933. This is the thrust of the New Deal. The Four Quarters projects, so there were many small projects, but they were organized by these macro projects on four corners of the United States around the Tennessee Valley Authority, the rural electrification projects that brought electricity to the South, that industrialized farms that had been using 200-year-old technology very uselessly, and also reclaimed desert land by terraforming desert areas through wise water management resources. You had the Grand Coulee dam projects of the Columbia River Treaty Basin area. You had the St. Lawrence Seaway area for New England in Canada. You also had the Hoover Dam area, which was the biggest dam. Which all of these things were revolutionary, they were transformative, and they created a long-term orientation for society again. Tennessee illiteracy went from 20% in 1932 to 80% in 1950. These areas became the backbone for the aerospace industry later that had formerly been like, you know, the show The Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah. That was what things were like in the 20s and 30s. That, you know, people were just playing banjos with no education, a lot of racism, a lot of ignorance, not a lot of long-term living standards. And it was transformed to be a driving force of economic progress that was utilized by the space program, everything else, within only 20 plus years. Franklin Roosevelt's quote, I love this, where he said, describes the old fallacious notion of the bankers on the one side and the government on the other side as being more or less equal and independent units has passed away. He's referring now to those central bankers who believe that the central banks should always be private and independent of politics. That's never true, because the people controlling the central banks have political agendas. They just don't want you to, they don't want you to know about them. That's why Mark Carney is good at what he does. But Roosevelt did not believe that. And he made the point, government by the necessity of things must be the leader, must be the judge of the conflicting interests of all the groups in the community, including the bankers. This did not sit well with obviously those who were his enemies. During this time, Roosevelt survived an assassination attempt, the same period that Kurt von Schleicher was being assassinated or was being ousted at the time. Before his assassination, you had a February 1933 assassination attempt by an Italian Freemasonic anarchist named Giuseppe Zingara, who tried to shoot Roosevelt at a speech. And a woman in the audience saw his gun, hit his hand, And he ended up shooting a few other people, including the mayor of Chicago, Cermak, who died saying a few weeks later from his wounds. Roosevelt also survived an overthrow, a coup led by General Smedley Butler, who many people might have seen originally from perhaps Michael Moore's documentary on the corporation, where Smedley Butler played along with this plan that was being run by the J.P. Morgan machine to recruit him because he was seen as the leader of the striking legionnaires, 500,000 strong World War I veterans who had not received their bonus pays. And the idea was to use him as a tool to storm the White House, install him as a fascist puppet dictator. And he played along. He got lists of names. He went to the Congress. He blew the whistle. They made a video, which you can watch on YouTube, of him going through the plot. And luckily, he was a patriot who blew the whistle. But still, I mean, it came close. So Roosevelt understood the nature of his enemies pretty well at this point. Despite that, they didn't lose opportunities to kick the crutches out from the rehabilitation patient. And at various times in 36, 37, the Wall Street financiers worked very hard to cut off credit for the real economy. And so the New Deal was always a fight. It was never an easy thing. By the time World War II happened, many of his enemies, Roosevelt's enemies, had to give in. People wonder, why is it that the British and the Wall Street banks that had funded Hitler and Mussolini, why did they end up fighting Hitler and Mussolini? It's a paradox for many people. The reason why is Hitler, I mean, to be straightforward, didn't want to be the second tier enforcer within the New World Order. Hitler always admired the British. He saved the British on several occasions in various strategic wars when he could have wiped out the British. He chose not to because he always respected the British as a fellow pure stock of Anglo-Saxon, you know, genetics. And he wanted, in his vision of the New World Order, which Lord Lothian describes after a meeting with Hitler in 36, he describes how he wants Britain to control the darker skinned races of much of Africa, of India, much of China, because they're good at that. And the idea was that the American fascists would have the jurisdiction of the Americas. So people around the J.P. Morgan Rockefeller Foundation networks were going to be controlling that jurisdiction. And Germany and Italy would have their share. Germany would control much of the Eurasian mass. Russia would be the Slavic zone to exploit the cheap labor and agriculture and mining. Italy would have some controls also of Europe and maybe some of Africa and the Mediterranean. So that was the way the world was going to be divided. Highly decentralized governments with local controls, with very top-down controls of banking and political structures run by a small coterie. And Hitler just didn't want to be the second tier. You know, he was like, we have such a machine here. We can be the ones driving it, and Britain can be our partner on equal or maybe even inferior levels. And Britain would not permit. Some of them wanted that. You know, King Edward VIII wanted that. He was the one who taught Elizabeth the Hitler salute. And he always had a plan to be installed as the fascist king of England all the way through World War II. So that ultimately was changed as they ousted the king. They gave him a little scandal to have an excuse to leave. And there was a decision made on the House of Lords and certain members of the British Parliament that they would not do that. Neville Chamberlain was also ousted and replaced with a more anti-Nazi image of Churchill. But FDR became really the spearhead of the fight at a certain point after 41. And they couldn't control their Frankenstein monster. And that's why I say hyperinflation, fascism, and war, how the New World Order can be stopped once more, because history is fluid. There's a fight. You know, the oligarchy, yes, does have a lot of power. They have been at this for a long time. But people project, I think, too much power onto the oligarchy's controls. And they forget that, no, if they really had the control that they project, they would have already have gotten done what they want today to do many times over. The fact that they have been thwarted time and again is a testament to something within the human condition that allows us to overcome this evil. And it's important but we can't do it if we don't know this history. And I love this picture of Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill. And Churchill was... You'll always have Stalin and Churchill on other sides of each other, because for all of Stalin's problems, he liked Roosevelt a lot more, and neither Roosevelt nor Stalin trusted Churchill at all. They both knew that he was a rat whose job was to just preserve the global empire. That was Churchill's primary job, which is why Churchill also postponed the creation of the opening of a second front, which would have put an end to the war far, far earlier than it did. So Churchill's job was to prepare the groundwork for a reorganization of the global empire after World War II. In his fights with Churchill, and they were opposing forces. Roosevelt was not Churchill's buddy, unlike what the history books say. Roosevelt's son, Elliot Roosevelt, wrote a book called As He Saw It, wherein he documents the fights that occurred in Casablanca between Roosevelt and Churchill over what the post-war world was going to look like. Roosevelt had a clear understanding of the need to liberate countries of the world by converting the arsenal of war into an arsenal of democracy, by utilizing the engineering powers of the military to help build, and also the industrial powers of the American system, which was the only system that was not crushed during World War II, but to use that as a way to help third world countries that had been abused by colonialism, to help them develop modern infrastructure, modern education, full spectrum economics. And people could read this book for free online, As He Saw It. Wonderful book. I just took a little snippet from it here, but he goes through, like, we can make the deserts of the Sahara bloom like a cabbage patch if you do things right by internationalizing the New Deal. And he had a lot of people that he had organized with to do this as a new type of system of win-win cooperation for India, South America, you name it. And in this, he talks to Elliot after a day fighting with Churchill, and it's very clear Churchill's job is to preserve the empire. He says, I'm talking about another war, Elliot, and he's already warning about the designs to create a third world war. He's talking about the war against empire, that's it. I'm talking about what will happen to our world if after this war we allow millions of people to slide back into the same semi-slavery. Don't think for a moment, Elliot, that Americans would be dying in the Pacific tonight if it had not been for the short-sighted greed of the French and the British and the Dutch. Shall we allow them to do it all over again? Your son will be about the right age, 15 or 20 years from now. One sentence, Elliot, then I'm going to kick you out of here. I'm tired. It's very late at night. This is the sentence. When we've won this war, I will work with all my might and main to see that the United States is not wheedled into the position of accepting any plan that will further France's imperialistic ambitions or that will aid or abet the British Empire in its imperial ambitions. And again, if you look at the battles during Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944 with Harry Dexter White, the head of the American delegation, which had delegates from India, from China, from South America and beyond, all over the world, present designs for the reconstruction of their societies, all of which received the full support of the United States. The idea was to illegalize speculation on commodities and currencies by fixing the exchange rates. At the time, it was to the US dollar. That was because the dollar was stable. It had a physical economic backing to it. So it was a good basis for international exchange. John Maynard Keynes, who, by the way, we are told is what Roosevelt was an adherent to, was actually a liar. He was there representing the Bank of England and the British interests. His solution was to allow zero real development of darker skinned nations. Keep in mind, John Maynard Keynes was a eugenicist. He was the treasurer of the Eugenic Society of Britain, which later became the Galton Institute, as was Churchill. They were both eugenicists. They were both Malthusians. They both believed in world government and depopulation. And John Maynard Keynes wanted a bancor, a one world currency controlled by the Bank of England, to be the basis of international exchange. That was rejected in the favor of sovereign nation states and multipolarism instead of unipolarism at that time. So why didn't it happen? Well, unfortunately, the allies of Franklin Roosevelt, people like Harry Hopkins, who's there with Stalin on the upper left, Sumner Wells, the Secretary of State, who was ousted in a scandal in 1943, Wendell Willkie, who was also there with Stalin and with Chiang Kai-shek, who was sort of, he was the head of the Republican Party, who was the Republican New Dealer who traveled around the world for 500 days to organize world leaders around internationalizing the New Deal. He wrote about it in his book, One World. Henry Wallace, who's there with Roosevelt, was the former vice president, a great anti-imperialist, who was formerly the agricultural secretary, and who later on, after he was ousted in favor of Truman, who was a banker's boy, as vice president in January 45, FDR's early death in April 12, 45, resulted in Truman, a complete George Bush Jr. style intellect, a puppet, to become the president who loved Churchill and created a new Anglo-American alliance under the Cold War and established, basically broke all the alliances that Roosevelt had created, had forged with Russia and with China, and went instead with the British intelligence angle, which was to create a new world based upon communism versus capitalism and an age of global terror, of nuclear annihilation. And on the right is, bottom right is Harry Dexter White, the guy who I mentioned ran the Bretton Woods Conference and also was the first manager and head of the IMF before he was killed. And I say killed, he was in 1948. At the very least, his death was very suspicious and untimely. And he was the last sort of anti-imperial leader of the IMF. After that point, the Vipers took control of the IMF, the World Bank, and other Bretton Woods institutions. I'll end it with one last note. Eisenhower tried in a limited way to push back against this, but he didn't understand what John Foster Dulles, who was largely a big handler of him, he didn't understand a lot of the complexity that Roosevelt understood of the deep state. Roosevelt was more savvy. But by the end, by 1960, Eisenhower did his famous military-industrial complex speech, which I think everyone knows about, and warned and organized a young Kennedy who was preparing to take the helm. Charles de Gaulle, Eleanor Roosevelt spent a lot of time as well organizing young Kennedy and his brother into the nature of what they were stepping into. Papers have been written on this. My new book, The Clash of the Two Americas, will feature several chapters going through this. People can get this in about 3 weeks' time on CanadianPatriot.org or RisingTideFoundation.net, the two sites I manage with my wife, Cynthia. But all that to say, there's one quote: JFK brought back the legacy of FDR as his fight against the Cold Warriors that were pushing the Bay of Pigs, that had programs to even do limited nuclear war on Russia. Within his own joint chiefs, people like Lyman Lemnitzer, the head of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, were part of this cabal. People like Alan Dulles, who ran and largely installed the Gehlen networks back into control of Germany after World War II to run West German intelligence. I mean, a lot of these Nazis were employed by Alan Dulles and British intelligence to manage the world order after World War II. So JFK fired Alan Dulles. He went to war with the Joint Chiefs and tried on several occasions valiantly to bring back the New Deal spirit by building big continental water projects, by initiating the space program, getting people to think outside of the limits to growth. Think about the future, think about the universe, and think about your relationship to that universe. That's the only way you can create a citizenry capable of having the moral fitness to survive and see through projects that are, you know, long-term. He also, I would just say, we just hit the anniversary of his last United Nations speech in September 20th, 1963, before he died. He gave a speech, which is a brilliant speech. I wrote an article on this, calling for a U.S.-Russia joint space program together. It's a gorgeous speech, saying, why replicate all of this science and expensive research together? Why don't we just break out of the Cold War and begin to build trust again by working together on doing something which involves exploring the universe together? That would have changed the rules of the game, which is, as I said at the beginning, the only rules of the great game is you cannot break the rules of the great game. So that was not permitted. Though Khrushchev said later on that he did want to go along with that. But JFK talks about FDR, and I'll end it here to wrap it up, I think, where he says, we in the USA and Europe both believe in the achievement of social justice and in the progress of all our people. We both believe in democracy at what Americans call the grassroots, placing the individual ahead of the state, the community ahead of the party, and public interests ahead of private. Ask not what you can do for you, but what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country, type of idea, but to harmonize the good of the whole and the good of the inalienable rights of the individual as well, right? Both are sacred. The fascist doesn't believe that. During the 1930s, when despair and depression opened wide the gates of many nations to fascism and communism, my own nation adhered to the course of freedom under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt. His administration introduced a high degree of social, economic, and political reform than America had previously seen, including tax and budget reforms, land and agricultural reforms, political and institutional reforms. Workers were assured a decent wage. Older citizens were assured of a pension. Farmers were assured of a fair price. Working men and women were permitted to organize and bargain collectively. Small businesses, small investors, and small depositors and banks, thanks to the Glass-Steagall Law, were given greater protection against the evils of both corruption and depression. Farms were electrified. Rivers were harnessed. Cooperatives were encouraged. Justice, social and economic justice, as well as legal, became the right and the opportunity of every man, regardless of his means or station in life. So that rounded, I think, up my idea. Obviously, the article itself goes more in detail. If people want statistics and a deeper breakdown, they can read the article, they can buy my book and do the research. But I think that at the very least covered about 100 years. That's why the Great Reset is happening.
Yeah, it makes sense. And you're right. We can only do the right thing if we know history. And this is really, really important. So it's all right there. It's the New Deal. It's sort of like the New Deal. It's not the New Green Deal or whatever they call it, but it is the New Deal as envisioned by FDR and then later by JFK. I think that's great. I think that's really great. Excellent. Matthew, this is great, really. I'm very grateful.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, of course. How can you not like it?
and I hope it's useful. And I'm glad you said Green New Deal because, yes, they are trying to do a Delphic sleight of hand by evoking something people feel strongly about as a vague memory, mm-hmm. but they took up the soul of it. They like the form of the New Deal in terms of the government control. They like that.
Yeah.
They like the idea of forcing credit to go to certain things like infrastructure. They like that, but they want to define infrastructure around windmills and solar panels and green grids, which will have the opposite effect of the real New Deal. So the real New Deal was building infrastructure that increased the productive powers of industrial labor. It created, right? It allowed you to produce more at higher quality to sustain more people at more education. The Green New Deal, you will create a spike of jobs to build a lot of windmills and solar panels. Sure, that's going to happen. But once they're built, they produce such a low quality of energy that you cannot power industrial economics. You cannot melt industrial steel. You cannot build industrial infrastructure. You can't sustain your population. And you don't need a mentally powerful population either. All you need to maintain a squeegee, hectares of solar panel plants are squeegees, people to just like squeegee off the sand and dust that collects every few days. That's all you need. So there's no educational level required.
No, absolutely not. It's very obvious. I mean, if you take a closer look at what's been going on over the last year and a half, if you look at the history lesson that you just gave us, it's a misnomer. Green New Deal isn't Green New Deal. It's fascist New Deal. That's what it is.
It's depopulation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. This is really important. And, you know, it came right. This is the perfect point in time, I would say, because we're going to have our general elections on Sunday. So I'm hoping that as many people as possible are watching this and are going to watch this before they go to the polls. This is both enlightening and it's inspiring. And how can you be how can you do any better than this? It's perfect.
Yeah, we have to bring back the spirit of Alfred Hauhausen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because again, like when people look at some of these great German statesmen mm-hmm. that are underappreciated, Hauhausen was assassinated in 1989 for a very specific reason, because he was trying to bring back, he was the head of the Deutsche Bank.
Yeah.
Right? And he was trying to revive this spirit of development that the Kernstadt für Wiederaufbau used to be, used to do that. And he wanted to bring that back. He wanted to forgive third world debts. He wanted a spirit of international collaboration on big projects that's the only way to stop this type of Malthusian Great Reset type of Davos thinking is to really revive, help nations stand on their own two feet, empower sovereign nations to have full spectrum economics, empower them to have education, and give people a future to aim for, right? Without a vision, the people perish, said Solomon. So it's still true.
Yeah. And that's what got him killed.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
They all think it's the RAF. Well, who was pulling their strings? That's the big question.
Well, and who was pulling the strings? When you start looking, one of my colleagues, Martin Seif, has done incredible work. He's a writer at Sputnik News, and he was the former Washington Times correspondent for the Washington Times for 25 years. Really brilliant fellow. But he's done incredible amounts of work on the imperial control of terrorist cells, anarchist terrorist cells, going back to the 19th century. Things like the organization console, but also like the networks that killed McKinley, mm-hmm. Run by Emma Goldman in 1901. These were all tied to British intelligence. You'll always, as soon as you start piercing the onion, even back then, you'll find the same sort of institutions behind the scenes deploying what appears to be independently operating terrorist cells. And to this very day, this is it's hard to find any naturally occurring cases of terrorism that are not also being funded by the FBI, the CIA, MI6. You'll always seem to find that everywhere you look easily. And people have to try very hard not to see that.
And what do you think? Do you think there's that could be a way for the current, you know, government in order to introduce a little bit of stress onto the population, to introduce a few, fake or I don't know, like kind of enabled terror situations? Would you expect that for the near future?
That's in the nature of the game. Yes, certainly. You called it. Yeah, and people should be aware. I mean, look at the things that concern me right now are the sort of war game scenarios being deployed by the World Economic Forum in the last few months involving things like, you know, you've heard of cyber panopticon.
Yeah.
And the cyber panopticon thing is very startling. It's very similar to the Event 201 war game or pandemic scenario games, where they're basically dealing with these, you know, fictitious scenarios of what do we do when a terrorist cell or, let's say, an authoritarian nation state like Russia or China is to deploy an attack onto our electricity grids or our internet that shuts down our internet and our ability to sustain GPS that would take down planes, you know? And they're just running these scenarios innocently. Very similar to the sorts of things we saw before 9/11. There were these sorts of scenarios in the summer of 2001 that also involved, by the way, one of the scenarios was called Dark Winter, involving the deployment of a genetically modified smallpox by Iraq into the United States as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Yeah.
They ultimately chose to instead go with the planes because that was another scenario they were playing with, was planes crashing into World Trade Centers, and they had playbooks on this. So I think that, yeah, people should be keep their radar up very high because, yes, you're correct. These things are being used as psychological stress and trauma to justify. Obviously, now they're targeting increasingly domestic terrorism is the new fancy, cool thing to talk about. And even recently, they discovered that, who was it? The Satanist who was, forgetting his name now, but there was a... FBI files were declassified, or at least they were leaked, that demonstrated that one of these leading white supremacist group leaders, and who also runs a satanic cult, forgetting his name, has been on the payroll of the FBI since 2003 and received $80,000 since 2018. These are the types of characters they need to have there to justify the sorts of things that Biden and the technocrats controlling Biden are want to bring online increasingly as part of this overhaul, transformation of society into something very Orwellian.
Are you talking about the guy who ran this cult by the name of Nexium or something?
Something like that. Uh-huh. I have it written down, but yeah, I wrote an article on that last week and the name's escaping me.
That's all right. We know what you're talking about. We have to be aware. We have to be careful and cautious. and we will be. But now that we have the New Deal as a way out of this and as an idea to follow, I think that's great. I've been playing with this for a long time because we've been reading so much about it, not just during the corona crisis, but forever. And it's a good thing that you've brought this out into the open again, because it needs to be known by as many people as possible. It's inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah. I would just say, if people go on the risingtidefoundation.net website, we have breakdowns of what these projects look like in the modern day. There are, the thing to keep in mind is you do happen to have, there's no perfect country in this world that is not infested in various ways by deep state operations, okay? There's nobody who's not infected. You do have some who are more and others who are less infected, who have conducted their own fights to you know, purge this cancer from their own system. But nobody is liberated in that sense. However, what you do have coming out of the Eurasian parts of the world, not the transatlantic, but in Eurasia, you do have a coalition of nations around what are called the multipolar alliance. So the two ways of resetting the world economy currently, you have the unipolar rules-based order agenda, which is another word for new world order, of one center of command above nation states shaping the system. We know what that looks like. Then you have opposing to that, you have a countervailing view that no, it needs to be a multipolar, meaning nation states, right? That's what the United Nations Charter has enshrined in its base. It's just one thing. A lot of people have been told a lie. They've been told that the United Nations Charter is an extension of the League of Nations. That is not true. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made sure that the sacredness of the sovereign nation state would be enshrined in the United Nations Charter, and that the principle of the respect and non-intervention of any one power over another in a war of aggression would be enshrined legally in that organization. Now, the organization is very corrupt, right? Just like the IMF and World Bank. However, at the heart of it, there is something fundamentally useful. Like at the heart of the United States Constitution, there's something fundamentally useful despite the evil done in the name of the United States. So Russia, China, other countries working with the multipolar alliance are building big projects premised around cooperation, win-win cooperation, and also large-scale, long-term infrastructure that has the effect of increasing population and decreasing the debt enslavement. So there's a lot of things about the Belt and Road Initiative being a debt slavery thing. It's actually not true. It's just that it's the investments, the 130 countries are part of the Belt and Road Initiative, and that's growing. The entire thing is based upon empowering nations who are cooperating to develop industrial capacities to stand on their own two feet. Nigeria, Kenya, they're actually doing what the IMF, the Western financiers, never permitted, which is training generations of young people to become engineers and also have industries in your own countries. That is a very different way of thinking. Now, China has problems, and I'm not saying that this is a perfect thing. However, the oligarchy is afraid of this international alliance of nations around the Greater Eurasian Partnership or Multipolar Alliance. That's why they're encircling China and Russia with missile systems around full spectrum dominance. That's why they're running all sorts of psychological warfare in our media to demonize both countries as being the big fault of the world. All of our problems are caused by those two. And the deflection is taken away from the Anglo-American intelligence agencies that are actually the ones who have been at the center of all of these problems historically. Don't look at us. Look at those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Okay. That wraps it up, I guess, pretty much for this weekend. Thank you very much again, Matthew. I think we're going to talk some more a little later. To kind of catch up. But for now, just I can only wish you a very happy weekend.
You too. Thank you for having me on, and I wish your guests a happy weekend as well.
Thank you very much. Take care. See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.